I have the intelligence report from Port Merion, but I've crashed somewhere over the channel. I need to deliver it urgently. Maybe someone in this town can help.
Hey, who's out there?
I'm just a traveller.
Not with that Australian accent. You must be from the crash.
Yes. Can you help me?
Head into town. Go to La Grande Place and order lunch and tell them Hayden, codename Yvette, sent you.
What?
I'm sorry, I'm only prepared to say that sort of thing once. Just do it. Hurry!
Okay. Well, here I am at La Grande Place. What's that restaurant called? Le Bouzibou? Hello?
Hello. Are you lost? You don't look like someone who could afford our prices. There is a war on, I'm afraid.
My friend Yvette said this was a good place for lunch.
Oh, I see. Quickly, hide under the table. Ah, Herr Sturmbannfuhrer. Your bill, sir. I trust you enjoyed the evening.
Yes, thank you. I particularly enjoyed the plat du jour. But did I just see you hide an Australian under your table, monsieur?
No, sir. That was just a Britisher terror flyer.
Ah, that is good. There was an Australian here recently, a squadron leader Schmidt, or Smith. It is unfortunate he was shot trying to escape. He could have yielded much information. However, that was 2 weeks ago. Ah, I see that it is 3:30. I have an unhappy duty to perform. I need to start watching the Colin Baker era in preparation for the Sixth Doctor retrospective. You see, monsieur? So many fans watching intently, all trying to mask their fears, all wondering if they too will be forced to rewatch Colin's era. I find it most revealing. And now, if you'll excuse me.
Quick now, through the large metal doors at the back.
Not an ideal day for reviewing a Fourth Doctor historical. Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 187 of the Diddly Dumb Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
And I'm his companion, Marco.
And in the continuing absence of Hayden on his sabbatical towards pending second fatherhood, we have with us...
Surely you mean since Hayden disappeared after he got stuck in the Lavatorica?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I was forgetting the plot. We have with us, friend of the show, Mr. Dave Kitchen. Hi, Dave.
Hello, chaps.
Hello, Dave.
I was just going to check in our records what we were discussing last time you appeared, Dave. I've just entered Search for Kitchen, and I found umpteen examples of... Mark does his weird Dave Kitchen voice to read out a letter. So no.
I was last on talking about the rescue and the Romans.
What date was that?
Start of 2021.
Doesn't seem that long ago, at all.
Here we are. Dave was last with us on episode... God, only 146. That is nuts. Actually, it used to be. In the old days, it wouldn't have been that long ago. But now we don't keep to a rigid two-week timetable. It is much longer ago. Episode 146, back in April 2021. That's what we were talking about. Oh, that's where we opened with a return. Talking of reason why Hayden's on his sabbatical, that was the podcast where we announced the birth of Hayden's first child.
Oh.
Remembering meeting Dave at the Fitzroy Tavern in 2017. Travel-wise, that's something we better gloss over for Mark's sake. Oh, that's it. Because of Hayden's absence here, he sent an insert for the podcast, which was delivered by a stork down the chimney. Great Hartnell moments for Mark. Come in, come in. What's that?
I have no idea.
No.
Oh, wasn't that where, what's his name, turns up as Kerquillian at the end?
Yes, it is,
yeah. The doctor's back, and the doctor says very casually, oh, come in, come in.
Yes, yeah, of course it is, yeah.
Right. So, Dave, I was going to say what's been happening since last we recorded, but quite a lot, Dave, because you've been visiting the UK, haven't you?
I have. I was in Europe just a month ago.
We do apologise once again that all three of us were jam-packed busy, so we couldn't see you, unfortunately. But you were in quite a few places, weren't you, of Doctor Who fame?
Yes, I visited the filming locations of half a dozen Doctor Who stories during my trip around the United Kingdom, and some were definitely ones I've been trying to get to for a long time, so it was very, very pleasing to do that.
So you were in Port Merion, Wales again, after last time. I think everywhere the Welsh. So you were, what did you mean when you said on the Doctor Who Show podcast that you thought Port Merion was, you were surprised at how unfunctional it was?
I had only ever heard it referred to as a model village, and I kind of assumed it would be a slightly more working village than it actually turned out to be.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yeah, most of the buildings are really just sort of frontages or half buildings, that sort of thing. There are some working ones like the hall and where they have the cafe and the shops and the like, but it is far more just a model than I really anticipated.
It's very dreamlike, isn't it, in the way it's all set out? I mean, it's like when you have a dream and you'll be like, oh, I've just walked out of my house into a newsagent's, even though the newsagent's in real life is like 3 miles away from my house, and then you pop over a back wall and you're in your old school, which was in another town. And so, you know, it's all bits and pieces, isn't it, that don't really feel like they belong next to each other?
Well, yes and no. They feel like they belong next to each other aesthetically.
Mm.
So they're all very pretty and it's all very lovely and the right colours match and they're the right sort of concourses and the like, but none of them go to anywhere logical or functional.
As our listeners across the world reach down their copy of Freud after Mark reveals his dreams to us...
Do they still have the stone boat there? I'm thinking of the Prisoner TV series. I don't know if you saw that.
I don't remember seeing a stone boat. There was a wooden boat.
Down on the beach?
Down on the beach next to the hotel, yes.
Ah, but yeah, wonderful location. I really do hope to visit there. But it's not particularly easy. I mean, by Australian standards, it probably doesn't seem that far away. But by British standards, it's like really tucked away in a corner. And there's no big roads to get there, is there? Or it's quite an effort.
No, in fact, I literally had to drive over the death zone to get there.
Excellent.
Is that the new Welsh name for Snowdonia, is?
It is now the 20th season 20 box set out, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen your picture of it online yet, Dave, so I'm waiting for it.
By Australian comparisons, I mean, it's just down the road, isn't it?
In fact, I had lunch with Suki Kark in Birmingham before I went there, and he was absolutely baffled and bewildered that I sort of said, oh, I need to leave, I need to be in North Wales by dinner time. And he's like, that's not possible.
What did he say? Oh, you've mastered the Transmat device, have you, too? I remember in 1988, I was visiting family in Australia when the full size of Australia was brought home to me. I was staying with them in... a farm they've got in Toowoomba, which is sort of umpteen hours due west of Brisbane. And towards the end, they said, oh, before you go home, why don't you spend some time on the coast? So I got a coach up to the coast. This is about two-thirds of the way up from Brisbane up to Cairns, which is, I mean, Dave will tell you, that's quite a drive, isn't it?
That's about a third of a continent, yes.
Just as this coach set off from the coach station, the driver popped into what was clearly their headquarters and came up with some videotapes. Like, I thought, oh, great, well, he's going to play as a film during the coach journey. And obviously this was 1988, so it wasn't giant plasma screens, it was just a little TV screen descending from the ceiling of the coach. And he put it on, and for, I think it was getting close to a two-day journey, and we found that what he'd put on was, I don't know if you're familiar with Shoah.
No.
The nine-hour documentary film in French on the Holocaust. That's what he'd picked. I don't know if he was thinking, I'll choose this on something that's extremely long. It'll keep them occupied as opposed to, so keep them entertained.
I thought for a moment you were going to say he was going to put the box set of The World at War on or something.
Well, to be fair, it was probably more entertaining than if you put on Collins era box set or something. And then you popped over to, where is the Eye of Orion?
So the Eye of Orion is actually on the property that was where the guy who, the architect who designed Port Merion lived.
Oh, right.
So it's only about 20 minutes up the road. And his house, and he's quite nice, and then he's sort of got the gardens. And in the gardens is the stairway that Richard Herndl walks down before he gets time-scooped. And then about another 10 minutes walk sort of up the hill is this folly that he built his wife for their wedding anniversary. Just, you know, right. Hey, darling, I don't know what to get you for the wedding anniversary this year, so I've built you a mini fort. And that's where they filmed all those scenes at the Eye of Orion.
If we're honest, that's actually what Hayden's been doing the last few weeks. He's building Sophia Folly in the garden. And then the bit I found, this was all revealed, by the way, listeners, just to give you a plug, in the most recent episode of the Doctor Who show. But I think I found most entertaining was what you almost imagine as a Doctor Who fan who's based in London, that this happens to a fan, that they're on the underground and they're looking at the underground map saying, oh, now, where do I need to go? And they suddenly think, there's actually a station called Perivale. Did you actually visit Perivale?
I did visit Perivale. I've wanted to visit Perivale ever since I had that experience on the tube when I was 11. And I've finally got to go there now. And I started with Horsenden Hill, which is, you know, a hill with some stuff on the top of it. But then when you start to walk around the actual streets of Perivale, you really feel like it's quite familiar because it's stuff you've seen many, many times before. And I think it's the very quintessential London suburbs where they film a lot of those sort of TV shows. But no, I did go to a number of the streets and the playgrounds where they filmed Survival. And I took lots of photos of people's houses and I'm not quite sure what they thought watching me take photos of their houses. So I'm not quite sure whether they called the police afterwards, but no, it was really, really fun.
Maybe full of self-pitying teenagers.
No, it was very, very quiet. I think it was over 20 degrees, so the English were all indoors.
I've only ever been to Perivale once. I came out of the station and I came across this woman sitting on the curb and I thought she looked strangely familiar. And would you believe it was Manisha? I said, hello, Manisha, what are you doing sitting in the street? And she said, oh, would you believe it, Doc? White kids firebombed my flat again. Oh, honestly. And what else did you see in London?
I saw some of the locations for Remembrance of the Daleks, which were a bit more spread out than I expected, but I did get to walk past Coal Hill School from Remembrance of the Daleks and some of those streets. I got to finally see Marylebone Station, where the plague ravages London in the Silurians, which is one of my favourite scenes. And that is extraordinarily the same as what it was back in 1970. You go to Platform 2, and Platform 2 looks like Platform 2 did in 1970. You go outside and that sort of veranda where all the ambulances pull up in the Silurians.
What, with the big glass roof?
Yeah, it all looks exactly the same as it did. But probably the highlight in London was seeing the location by the Thames where the Dalek crawls out of the Thames at the end of Dalek Invasion of Earth Part 1.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was particularly special for me because when I was about 11, I met Robert Jewell. He came and did a convention in Australia along with Dudley Simpson and Sandra Reed. And he talked about how he sort of lucked out and he was about to get into his bathers and take his clothes off and then sort of be lowered into the Thames. And then you have to sort of count to 20 so the water settles above you before you can start coming back out again.
Yeah.
And the thing that he sort of liked the most about it was that when they came to do the movie, they said, well, look, mate, you're an expert at this, so, you know, we won't get someone else. Just do it again. You know what you're doing. So he went and did it all again.
I think Marylebone, although it's one of the main stations, in fact, so much so that Marylebone, one of the ones on Monopoly board.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, because something like Euston serves the North and Scotland, and as does King's Cross, they're always rebuilding it and making it bigger, whereas I think, because Marylebone serves the West Country and Wales, is it Wales, Mark? Yeah, possibly they're thinking, we better not expand it too much. It might encourage these people to visit London more often. So, did you by any chance meet anyone famous on the tube?
It's funny you should say that, Doc. It's almost as though you heard the podcast.
I know! I was making notes.
Meet is too strong a word, but I was on the tube going to the National Portrait Gallery, and so suddenly somebody walks into the carriage, sits down across the tube from me, and I look and go, I'm sure that's Bonnie Langford. And I couldn't be quite sure because I'm very familiar with Bonnie Langford as she looked in the, you know, late 80s. But I've seen her in, you know, docos and behind the sofas and stuff. So I sort of thought, that looks like Bonnie Langford. But then you have that fan moment of, do you just interrupt this person and say, by the way, are you Bonnie Langford? Or do you just sort of sit there politely, vaguely hoping that she notices you so that you can say hello? And unfortunately, she didn't.
Oh, it's difficult, isn't it, when you do see someone famous like that? I've said before on here, I saw Peter Cushing stood at a station in Whitstable, and he was just waiting for his train. And I really wanted to speak to him, but it felt disrespectful. It felt wrong to go up and just suddenly start saying, hey, just, you know, it's just, you want to let these people just get on quietly with their day, don't you, really?
Yeah, that's what I reckon.
People like Peter and Bonnie are people you're sure that they would be very polite and friendly if you did, but you're never entirely sure. See, I would be torn in that sort of situation between, are they being very polite but thinking, oh God, another bloody fan? Or even worse situation, it turns out to be not them.
I think Dave took the right approach in that you kind of look at them and you know, if you catch their eye and you get that eye contact, then that's more of a, you know, they'll acknowledge. I mean, obviously, I was at a convention at the time, but like Wendy Padbury came outside and sat down, and I sat there and I sort of looked over at her and she looked over at me and sort of smiled and went, oh, hello, you know, because she's like, yes, I'm Wendy Padbury. But it's that eye contact. If you get that eye contact with them, then sometimes it helps bridge the awkwardness, yeah.
Yes, and I certainly did better then than my one occasion when I met someone quite famous who I was a big admirer of, and was slightly dismissive of them until I realised who they were.
Who was that?
So my friend Richard was manning a club table at a local Star Wars convention, and I wasn't going because I was busy and I couldn't really afford the ticket. But he messaged me sort of late in the afternoon and said, look, it's getting a bit slow down here. No one's checking the front door. Why don't you just come and hang out with me for a bit? So I thought, yeah, I'll go hang out with Richard. And we had a bit of a chat, and he had a little sort of one of those old portable VHS TV players on the club table to try and attract a bit of attention. And he said, well, look, I've got a copy of some Blake Seven tapes in the bag. Why don't we just stick them on until I need to go? So we sat down. I think we were watching Gold. And then as I'm watching it, this sort of short, beardy, sort of scruffy little man comes up and he says, oh, is that Blake Seven? And I was sort of, yeah, mate, yeah. Oh, that's Avon, isn't it? Yes, mate, that's Avon, yeah, whatever. You know, I base my character of Talon Card on Avon. And then the wheels started clicking. I've gone, oh my God, you're Timothy Zahn. You're one of my favourite authors. Hello, how are you? But until then, I was just like, who is this annoying guy interrupting my Blake Seven?
Actually, in Australia soon, you're going to have another Doctor Who celebrity encounter, aren't you? Because you've got a favourite of the podcast, Katie Manning, coming over to visit.
She is. 2 weeks yesterday, she'll be in Sydney, and 3 weeks today, she'll be in Melbourne.
Yeah, it's at the 14th.
Yeah, the 14th in Sydney and the 22nd in Melbourne. So I'm going to the Melbourne one. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. I haven't seen Katie Manning since 1997, when a bunch of us all went up on the overnight train from Melbourne to Sydney with a bottle of scotch and sort of spent a large part of the weekend very hungover. But we did get to see Katie.
Ah, lovely. It's always great value, isn't it? It's wonderful.
So where else did you go in Europe?
I had a quick stop in Paris, so I did the Louvre. I did Spain, Romania, Athens, and the UK, and Iceland.
Didn't you... It was you, wasn't it, that bought the special ticket so you go to the front of the queue for the Mona Lisa?
Yes, I bought the skip the line queue for the Louvre, which was fortunate because that meant that my queue only lasted for 55 minutes.
Oh.
It was 35 degrees at the time, and as I was going to find where the skip the line queue started, I was walking past all the markers for the general queue, and they were sort of saying, "Oh, if you pass this point, you've only got 3.5 hours to go."
Well,
put it this way, if I hadn't had to skip the line, I wouldn't have gone. I wasn't going to spend 4 hours in a queue when I only had about 9 hours in Paris.
Wow. Oh, and you also went to somewhere that's particularly close to mine and Doc's heart, didn't you?
Yes, a friend of mine was trekking through Europe at the same time. We were trying to work out where we could meet, and it turned out that Brussels was sort of the point when we were closest.
Of course.
It was very easy to get a train from, obviously, London to Brussels. It's only about a two-hour trip. So I said, right, let's meet in Brussels. And I said to him, look, let's see what we want to see, and we'll have lunch and all the rest of it. But I said, I really need to see a particular location in the Grand Place. I really want to have lunch somewhere around there. I'll explain why when we get there. So he was a little bit bemused at first until I explained why I want to go and take this photograph of a sort of this old abandoned restaurant.
Which I didn't recognise at first. So I couldn't quite work out where it was. Doc, you got it, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've actually been there.
You haven't said where it is yet, by the way.
Oh, sorry. Yes, it's the exterior location for the restaurant Candide from Secret Army.
Oh.
Which is in one of the corners, isn't it?
It is. It's just on one of the corners that comes off the plaza. So I did see it. I had my photo there. And then we had lunch, just a couple of restaurants next to it. So that was very nice.
We once, with some of our pals from work, we once said, let's have a day out. And what we'd sometimes do is we'd save up and we'd go for lunch at take the afternoon off and go for lunch at some especially nice restaurant in London or something. We said, oh, look, let's take the Eurostar and go to Brussels. So we went to Brussels, and one of our mates who goes on the continent quite a while was saying, we'll have to be careful what sort of bars we go in. I said, why? Because Brussels has got this sort of dual language, dual ethnic thing between the north and the south. Sometimes in Brussels you can go into what's essentially a Flemish bar, order drinks in French, and they'll just blank you. Obviously not all of them, but some of them. Or might just be my friend is the sort of person who inspires this sort of attitude, or vice versa. So we end up going in a French bar. We were sitting there for about 6 hours just ordering beers and coffees and playing cribbage, I think. But I insisted that we go to the that we pop into the Grand Place. So, well, welcome to the Hoosium anyway, Dave. It probably wasn't not too good an idea to point out you'd returned to Australia, was it, to maintain the illusion that you're actually here in person? But there we are. Having heard the latest casting news for a forthcoming show, talking as we did earlier about having a clean tag on iTunes, I do wonder to what extent Beep the Meep, instead of going meep meep, will be going c**k, shit, f**k, because of course Miriam Margolyes has been cast as Beep the Meep, who actually, in acting roles, I find perfectly good. It's just that when she's being interviewed, she has this reputation of going on, I don't know, breakfast TV. Oh, we've got Miriam Margolyes interview, and she'll deliberately slip an Anglo-Saxon four-letter word into the conversation so she'll make the headlines. And it's half the people on Twitter will react with, oh, God, you know, that woman, seeking publicity by being crude. And the other half will, oh, isn't she a national treasure?
I always find those slip-ups very gauche in some ways, when I remember that Billy Connolly can do many, many interviews in family-friendly time and not ever accidentally drop a swear word when, you know, when he's performing, it's every second word. So I figure if Billy Connolly can behave himself, anyone can.
We've lost Michael Gambon the last few days, haven't we?
Yes.
Star of one of my favourite scenes in all of New Who. Possibly in All of Who, which is the sort of climax of the semi-climax of... Oh, semi-climax. I've got people using Anglo-Saxon words of
How gauche of you, Doc?
Christmas Carol, where he's saying to the Doctor,
Sorry. I didn't realise.
All my life I've been called heartless. My other life, my real life, the one you rewrote. Now look at me.
Better a broken heart than no heart at all.
Try it. You try it. Why are you here?
Because I'm not finished with you yet. You've seen the past, present, and now you need to see the future.
Fine, do it, show me. I'll die cold, alone, and afraid. Of course I will, we all do. What difference does showing me make? Do you know why I'm going to let those people die? Not a plan. I don't get anything from it. It's just that I don't care. I'm not like you. I don't even want to be like you. I don't and never, ever will care.
And I don't believe that.
And show me the future. Prove me wrong.
I am showing it to you. I'm showing it to you right now. So what do you think? Is this who you want to become, Kazran?
Try it. And oh, glorious. Doctor Who Unleashed lands on BBC Three and iPlayer this November. I'm sure you can understand that my use of the word lands implies that I've entirely copied and pasted this from the Radio Times, which is going to be a sort of, what did they call it in the early days? Doctor Who Confidential, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's going to be Doctor Who Confidential in everything but name.
Host Stephen Powell. Can't say I'm familiar with him.
No.
BBC gaming correspondent and former Radio 1 Newsbeat presenter has been given the keys to the TARDIS and blah, 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 blah.
So many people have got keys to the TARDIS now. It's quite a security risk, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Stephen is a presenter and journalist from the Amman Valley. Oh, not again! South Wales, they get everywhere!
We're indomitable.
Yeah, a familiar voice to millions. He became BBC News' first ever gaming and culture correspondent in 2021. Fancy having people who are just culture representatives. I mean, I can't understand how anyone could do that.
I'm just a bit confused about gaming and culture being in the same sentence there, but whatever.
Have we seen the trailer?
Yes.
What did we think?
I thought it was a trailer. These things are deliberately designed to create the largest possible expectation whilst giving the smallest possible amount away. Look, I know some people love to dive deep into them and they pause every scene and they look at every frame and they blow it up and they try to work out, well, this could mean that this is happening. And I just sort of look at it and go, hey, the trailer means Doctor Who's coming soon. And that's good. And, you know, let's not dive too much into the, you know, continuity of this.
Yeah. I was particularly thrilled by the bits that look like they're straight out of the Starbeast comic strip. So that was really nice. They look like they've done some bits of that really, really well. I did speak to one fan earlier this week who, because, I mean, if you look over the internet, pretty much I'd say 95%, 98% positive comments about the trailer. Real excitement, people really thrilled, people really pumped and looking forward to the new series. But I did speak to one fan who wasn't quite so happy to be seeing the return of David Tennant. Would anyone like to guess who that fan might be?
Well, it could be someone very close to us, not a million miles away from this room. Well, are we thinking of someone else?
Well, I'm just saying, think of someone who's no stranger to the Who's Ian.
I think the point that Dave makes is, in retrospect, thinking about it, I thought, am I being unkind? RTD has clearly brought back Tennant and Tate for a purpose. And so it would be daft for him, having done that, to not make the main focus of the trailer those elements of Tennant and Tate, which people clearly love from the earlier days of New Who. It's just unfortunate. But those are the ones I found most irritating.
Yeah.
says, oh, it's Kate Lethbridge-Stewart! Donna continued doing her fishwife, shouty, what are you talking about, spaceman?
Yes, look, I'm probably in the same category as you, Doc. I'm not a particular fan of Tennant and his era and Tate and her performances, but it's funny, this morning I started watching some of the extras on the Five Doctors Blu-ray, and in particular I was watching Behind the Sofa, and looking at how people just reacted to, you know, Pertwee coming back and Nicholas Courtney coming back, I thought, there is going to be a generation of fans now for whom seeing Tennant and Tate on the TV again will be like us watching The Five Doctors and saying, oh my God, there's Lalla Ward. Oh my God, there's Wendy Padbury. Yeah. So, you know, it's sad, but it's not quite for us.
I'm not particularly turned off. It's just that, Lord, I thought we got rid of all this.
I'm not turned off. I'm just saying it's probably not going to hit us quite the same way it's going to hit people who grew up with New Who.
I did think one of my main impressions was, if Russell is hoping that this will bring back an old audience, I do wonder how much it will tug on the hormones of teen girls from 20 years ago. Now that David Tennant seems to look 60, I do think that heavy 5 o'clock shadow isn't flattering.
No, but I think they're trying to emphasise that it's not the 10th Doctor. Is that correct?
That's interesting, because I was thinking this. I thought, God, he's aged. And then I just happened to see on YouTube a very recent interview with him. I said, he's nowhere near that old. And I wonder if they have artificially aged him like that for some reason.
Well, because RTD's been very clear that he is playing the 14th Doctor and Shooty is the 15th. So I suspect they are trying to make it very clear that he's not the 10th.
Also, he's got spectacularly defined manga hair now, hasn't he, really?
It's sort of a 10th Doctor's Final Fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's auditioning for a part in season 2 of One Piece.
I suppose if they're going to rapidly age him, they're going to do a leisure hive with him, have him as Tom as Father Christmas.
Oh, I just thought they were going to have him in 90 minutes of TV with no plot. But yeah, I see what you're saying now.
We had one or two bits of correspondence, which are a bit late, I'm afraid, in that I've completely missed them on Facebook during our last episode. So they're mainly talking about our two doctors. Who did we do two doctors with?
Ourselves.
Or was it just the two of us?
Just the two of us, yes.
Well, that was the point, wasn't it? Yeah. We've had a message from friend of the show, Johnny Dabb. Hello, diddly dum. Excellent episode. Yes, it must have been the one with only two of us. It was an excellent episode. Excellent episode where you reviewed your in-flight movie. Of course. I really quite like this serial and score it 8 out of 10. To be honest, I think you pretty much said everything there is to say about this serial. Of course. It really does amaze me how in the classic era the look of the Sontarans deteriorates through the show. Lynx is easily the best Sontaran, and Stike and his underling are clearly the cheapest looking. Like they can't even get the mouth to move properly, whereas with the head of Lynx from the Time Warrior, the movement of the mouth looks very good. But to be fair to the Sontaran actors, big heavy costume and summertime in Spain probably didn't mix well. Anyway, as said, excellent episode, and I'm really looking forward to your 6th Doctor retrospective. Well, I'm glad someone is, Johnny.
Sicko.
Yours, Johnny D. Keep punching. Oh, darn, wrong podcast. Can't think what made me think of 42 to Doomsday. Another pint of Castlemaine 4X, please, was Club Tropicana waiter. P.S. Yes, my youngest daughter knows all the bad language. I blame these modern schools. They have some strange subjects these days. Double swearing on Wednesdays. We also got a line from Dominic Smith. Always a highlight to get a new episode. Thank you for your amazing content, insight and humour. Clearly, that was you and me, Mark.
Oh, that's very kind.
We hope you're not trapped in Australia for long, sport. And then I was going to leave this till next time, but then we'll constantly be one behind. So I'll get some Johnny's correspondence on Planet of Fire in. Hello, diddly dum. I really like this story. Hang on, he's just said that about. Does he like all of them?
Call himself a fan?
I really like this story, and I would score it 9 out of 10. I think that going to Lanzarote was the right thing to do. The location footage looks fabulous, luxurious in places. Yes, I must admit, I do think that sort of wooden floored apartment looks completely out of place, given that the rest of them are all living in caves. Luxurious in places and desolate in others, and it's in conjunction with an excellent score from Peter Howell, one of his best synth pieces, in my opinion, and it really makes me want to visit just so I can go and track down the beach, Timonov's house and the crash site. Also, the view from where that telescope is. All looks fabulous to me, and is also a bloody good excuse for a holiday. I also love the plot with the Master, Chameleon and Perry. I find all the characters believable except Perry, who falls right into the Doctor's companion role way too quickly. I have to admit that I do find it a little bit slow in places, but watching in episodic format solves that for me. Great diddly dull episode. Many thanks, Johnny D. And given that we had to go through the whole palaver, a reviving Mark from the heart attack he suffered when we revealed that we'd received a ratings comment on iTunes. The shock of it happening. I thought it was it's only polite in retrospect to actually read it out. So, almost as a point of pride, faithless listeners, we refuse to beg you for reviews on iTunes. It sounds as if we're really pleading, but do leave them if you like. As someone I think recently said, a good review on iTunes is often far better than huge audience ratings for boosting a show. If I could give this more stars, I would. Definitely the best Doctor Who podcast out there. Very entertaining and overall just brilliant. Oh, right.
Aww.
Because if more of you thought it was the best podcast out there, we'd have to change our opening, wouldn't we? Every week. Right. And the reason the shock is that was the... That actually was posted in January, and I just noticed it. And the reason the shock was, that was our first iTunes review since December 2020. So,
also, funny thing, after the Planet of Fire review with Mark from 42 to Doomsday, as I do, I have a look through the through some of the social media comments relating to the Diddly Dun podcast, and I kept seeing people say, oh, it's great to hear Mark on the Diddly Dun podcast. And there'd be this moment where I'd go, oh, that's wonderful. And then I'd see, from 42 to Doomsday. and then so I might start, I'm on the Blue Sky social media app, which I managed to get an invite to. Thank you to Mark Cochran for that. And I've put in my bio on that I am, with respect to the Diddly Dun tagline, I put on that I am the fourth best Mark in Doctor Who podcasting out there.
I was just about to make that crack. this must have been a long time ago. The last rating we had on iTunes but one. Great hosts who all come across as being really knowledgeable and humble. God, who was hosting the podcast then? I can't remember. And then the one before that. Despite their characteristic modesty on this matter, this is probably the best Doctor Who podcast out there. Modest? That's not us. Full of thoughtful language, real but lightly wielded intelligence. Now, that was clearly me. Real but lightly wielded intelligence. People-loving instincts.
Mine's very lightly wielded.
I know, and a wonderful goofy charm. Very much a reminder of the spirit of the old times without ever being cobwebby or dull or resistant to the future. You can't marry it, but subscribing is probably the next best thing.
Oh, that's lovely.
I'd like French wine, cave cheese and handmade walking boots. It's getting better and better with age too. A bright blue light in the fog.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
Right, so let me just close our Diddly Dun iTunes account. So, we thought, Dave's just visited Port Merion. What story should we review that goes along with that? And I said, oh, God, whales again. I can hear, I don't know if people start turning on the Diddly Dun podcast expecting to hear Men of Harlech in the background all the time. We are, of course, reviewing The Twin Dilemma. Mask of Mandragora. Season 14 story from the golden Hinchcliffe Holmes era. written by Louis Marx, directed by Rodney Bennett. Seems to have had umpteen attempts at finding a title, from A Catacombs of Death to Doom of Destiny. What came up with that? Doom of Destiny, Secret of the Labyrinth, Curse of Mandragora, before they finally landed on Mask of Mandragora. Mark, what did you think of Mask of Mandragora?
Well, obviously, this is the era I grew up with, and it's good, but I would say this is one of the B-class bakers.
Mm.
Baker Major, that is. For me, I know at the time I would have been far more interested in some much more far-fetched, fantastical sci-fi stuff. And even now when watching it, I think I find it, although I enjoy a lot of the BBC drama flourishes of it, you know, the RSC actors, the great costuming, the, you know, all that goes into it. And I do appreciate that. But also at the same time, I don't know, I find it a little bit dry, I think, for my tastes. I still really enjoy it because Liz and Tom are always great to watch together. And there's loads of great scenes with them together.
Initial thoughts, Dave?
Yeah, I don't think what Mark's saying is in any way unfair. It does have the disadvantage of being right in the middle of the Hinchcliffe, Holmes, Tom, Liz era. And when your nearby neighbours are stuff like Seeds of Doom, Pyramids of Mars, Ark in Space,
yes,
Brain of Morbius, Robots of Death, you know, it's very unfortunate that it's got those neighbours. If this was in sort of season 15, 16, etc., it would stand out a lot more. I think it's a very good story. I think it's a very enjoyable story. It's a story that I've grown to love as I've got older. I think it really passed me by a bit as a kid when we were watching the endless Tom Baker repeats back in the 80s. But it looks good. It certainly has that feel now. And as fans, we start to notice these things of, you can see that this is the opening of a season and the money is very, very much there. Everybody's got a bit more time. Everybody's got a bit more budget. And everybody's sort of throwing a lot more at the production. And that's really, really obvious. It has one big flaw that I think is what lowers it from great to near great for me. And I'm sure we'll talk about that.
I understand what you mean, Mark, about the dryness. It's very much, while I'm always one to adore anything that brings to memory the era of received pronunciation, you know my obsession with that, I do think that there's an element of it which is a little too much the sort of Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening BBC drama series, where it's a little, it's reminded me slightly, I can't remember when they broadcast it, there was a drama series about the Borgias, which they did, I mean, God, when was that?
1981.
Oh, thank you, computer. On the BBC in 1981. And the Borgia Pope was played by Adolfo Celli, who I think is the huge-nosed villain in Thunderball. And I'm sure, as good as it was, I remember watching this and thinking, this isn't exactly as stunning as I would like. And it reminded me a little too much of that. It's not enough of a pseudo-historical to take you thoroughly out of the historical. It's not.
It's definitely showing its antecedents pretty directly, because there was a very foolish moment when I was watching this yesterday where I thought, oh, the uncle's killed the father and now is trying to kill the son so he can be king. They're doing the Lion King. Oh, no, sorry, no. They're both doing Hamlet.
Yes.
Its Hamlet origins are not even subtle. So it is very clearly laying into those roots.
Yeah.
Yes, the Giuliano Marco thing is very Hamlet Horatio, isn't it?
Yes.
Sorry, Mark, I bumped into you there.
You literally just said exactly the sentence I was about to say.
Gosh, we're it's like listeners, if you want to put a 5-star comment on iTunes saying the hosts are so simpatico that they're almost finishing each other's sentences for them. I mean, I love the... Is this the first ever TARDIS tour they've done? You know the bit where Susan attacks Ian and Barbara with the scissors?
Oh, right, yeah.
I can never work out, because they're lying on these, like, sunbeds, aren't they? And I can never work out whether that's in a a room outside the console room, or if it's just in a corner of the console room that we don't normally see. But I think this is probably the first time we step outside the console room, isn't it?
It's certainly the first time I think we do a proper tour. The Mind Dropper has the power room, which is separate to the console room, but that's literally just a sort of a blank room with a lump of electronics in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But no, it's the first time we really sort of get that impression of miles and miles of corridors, I think.
I think something could have been better. I thought, this is something that I don't usually say, but when they were, the way they did the boot cupboard, I was thinking, bring back Barry Letts and his experiments with CSO.
Yeah, that was a difficult moment, but I thought that they did a lot of good with not much for that scene where they land in the Mandragora Helix.
I mean, obviously the effects, they look cheap, especially by modern day standards, they look cheap, they look dated, but they've actually been quite ingenious, haven't they, with what they've done with such a small part of the budget. So, I mean, presumably most of the budget on this went on the location filming and the costuming, I would expect.
And the driving there, I think.
Yeah, well, exactly.
But also the cast, it's got a huge cast.
Yeah.
And indeed, one of pedigree. Can I just sort of mention a couple of I recognised him from moments in this?
Mm.
So Giuliano, Gareth Armstrong, I recognised from Blake 7. He's in Star 1. He's one of the technicians in Star 1. He's also the English voice of Sandy in Monkey. I don't know if you got Monkey in the UK. But
yes. Oh, yes, we did. Fantastic.
Rossini also plays Bill Pritchard in Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister.
Yes, the Prime Minister's Press Secretary, yeah. God, I'm just thinking. The Alistair Campbell, de Nogeur. I didn't realise he was quite that evil, actually.
There are no votes for me in giving money to the arts, but there's a lot of terrible publicity if you take it away. The arts lobby is part of the educated middle class. It's one of the few ways they can get their income tax back. Mortgage tax relief, university grants, lump sum pensions, Radio 3, and cheap subsidised seats at the theatre, the opera and the concert. You can't begrudge it us. There.
The priest is, of course, Robert James, who's in the very first episode of Blake 7. He's the doctor that discusses the meaning of reality with Blake.
Oh.
But my favourite is John Lorimer, who played Count Federico, who was in only a couple of scenes of I, Claudius, but one of them is one of my favourites, which is the bit where Caligula awakens from his coma.
Yeah.
And he says to Lorimer's character,
"Recovery is a miracle."
"But you prayed for it, Lancelus."
"Night and day. But our prayers are not always heard."
"Yes, but yours were very special, so I understand. You offered your life to the gods in the place of mine. That was extremely noble."
"It's true. I did."
"And what are you going to do about it?"
"Do about it? What do you mean?"
"Well, I'm still here, and so are you. But we oughtn't both to be here. Should we not give the gods the things that we promised them? You're in danger of the crime of perjury, Lentulus. Think about it. But not too long. The gods won't wait forever, of that I can assure you. I know them only too well."
Oh, that's great. I've got quite a lot of I, Claudius vibes from watching this, actually.
Yes, yeah.
It's obviously, it's from pretty much the same time, isn't it? Would have been in production around about the same time, I think. And I think a lot of the acting choices are very similar to those that are made in I, Claudius, you know, like because in I, Claudius, obviously you've got this immense raft of almost, it seems, everyone who's ever been in the RSC or whatever appearing on screen. And I think that translates a lot into the acting style. It's all very Shakespearean, isn't it? And Tim Pigott-Smith as well, I don't know why, watching him, there's just something about him that looks like he's still on a stage playing Horatio,
yes,
doesn't he? The way he holds himself, I think there's a bit where he sits down at a table and he sort of puts his chin in his hand and sort of think.
Yes.
Contemplation. And that seems incredibly like as if he was on a stage doing it for a live audience, you know. And I get that a lot with I, Claudius as well. So,
in fact, Tim Pigott-Smith said on the making of documentary that he and Gareth Armstrong had done a number of Shakespeare's together and a number of plays together. And he said when you watch them, you can see that they've been classically trained and they know how to walk in tights, they know how to hold a sword, they know how to sit down with a sword.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Modern actors would probably be arguably a lot more naturalistic, but I don't think it's quite as evocative as this sort of style.
Yes, I immediately recognise, not necessarily John Lorimore himself, as Lentulus from I, Claudius, but more of his nose, I think. There's a wonderful moment on the Blu-ray behind the sofa where Tom and Louise and Philip Hinchcliffe are on the sofa together. And we know what it's like with Tom. His memory's a bit shaky of that long ago now. And John Lorimore's on for his first episode, peering at him. He just leans over to Louise and says, "Who's the nose?" She says, "John Lorimore." "Oh, yes. Very, very precise actor."
"Search every corner of the palace."
"Who's the nose?"
"John Lorimore."
"Oh, yes."
Was also far more important than minor trivia like I, Claudius, was, of course, gentlemen. I mean, David, please get your priorities right. In Secret Army.
He was.
A Question of Loyalty, which I think is the one where Monique bonks the SS undercover officer. Although, to be honest, I've seen, it's one of those annoying things on IMDb where I can't actually tell who it is they're referring to. I didn't particularly want to rewatch the episode. Norman Jones, who plays Hieronymus, was also played Chris Song in Abominable Snowmen. And the Major Baker in the Salyorians, who's the nutter who starts drawing dinosaurs on the wall.
No, he's the one that gets the plague.
So who's the... Yes, you're right. Is he the one that goes into London?
No, that's Geoffrey Palmer who goes
into
London.
Civil servant, isn't it? Geoffrey Palmer, yes.
No, Norman Jones is Major Baker. He's the security chief at the base who runs off to find the Silurians and gets infected and then takes it back to the base.
Talking of Blake Seven, the voice of the Mandragora Helix was played by Peter Tuddenham.
Wonderful.
Who plays all the robots, their robots, all the computers on Blake Seven. And talking of Tim Pigott-Smith, I was reading up on this and he sounds lovely because he's absolutely... I mean, he may be awful, but he's sound as on Doctor Who, because he's got nothing but praise for it, working on it. Tom's theory of the programme was wonderful. He thought everyone under 16 should be behind the sofa with fear, and everyone else should be enjoying themselves enormously, which I think sums up Doctor Who perfectly. Yeah. Going back to the intro about wandering down the TARDIS, of course... We get our first introduction to the... Do we call it the old control room or the secondary control room?
Secondary control room, yes.
It's very sort of H.G. Wells, Jules Verne time machine. I love that sort of thing.
I love the decor of the room. I love the wood panelling and the stairs and all the rest of it. I really, really hate the central console, though, where it's just a couple of drawers with some push buttons. I like my big levers and my big buttons and my dials. I think that's really good. And just having a few coloured buttons was a bit of a shame. But I must confess, when I first saw The Mask of Mandragora, when I was, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, something like that, when it was broadcast here, or repeated here, I should say, I didn't know what a shaved mirror was. And so I just thought that big, strange wire contraption was a little sort of piss-weak time rotor.
I have to say that for years I had memories of the secondary control room as being far grander than it was. I used to talk to my friends about it and say, "Oh, do you remember when the TARDIS had that beautiful, beautiful wood mahogany panelled control room? It's amazing. It had all this brass in it. Oh, it's glorious." And then I remember finally sitting down to watch, I can't remember which of the stories it would have been that I saw first on VHS with it, which featured it, but I was like, "Oh, that's not really quite as good as I remembered it." I still love it, but I do know what you mean about the central console. Although I love the fact that Sarah goes, "That looks like a shaving mirror," and the doctor just goes, "Yes, it is a shaving mirror."
That's a bizarre line, isn't it?
"That looks like a shaving mirror."
"Yes, it is."
But I kind of like the fact that they lean into it. He doesn't try to say, you know.
Yeah, especially when she could have said, "Whose is this recorder?" Or, "Oh, that's one of Pertwee's shirts." Quite how the Third Doctor must have gone in there, wasn't he, to leave that shirt there? Which would suggest, I don't know, if the Third Doctor sometimes wanders around the corridors of the TARDIS, topless. Louis Marx, who wrote this. It's interesting, isn't it? I'm not sure to what extent this was common with them. I mean, he was at Balliol College at Oxford, that's sort of the effortless superiority college. And he did his PhD on Renaissance Italy, didn't he? So, which suggests that Philip Hinchcliffe wasn't just saying, oh, Louis, send us a draft script, will you? He clearly had in mind, as I think he mentions a couple of times, he's been to Port Mirian for other things. And he clearly had in mind, well, let's do something on Renaissance Italy. Who shall I get to do it? Oh, Louis Marx did a degree on that, didn't he? I think his thesis was called The Development of the Institutions of Public Finance in Florence During the Last 60 Years of the Republic, see 1470 to 1530, which I must say, as a title, seems so awkward and contrived that I'd long assumed it was a New Adventures title. Isn't that the one where Marie de Medici has sex?
It's interesting you say that, and I hadn't actually realised that about Louis Marx, but one of the things that I think stands out about this episode is both the effortlessness of the setting and the way they make it feel like 15th century Italy,
but
also the way that they do the whole science versus religion thing. And look, it's not subtle, I wouldn't go that far, but they do weave it into the story and the narrative. When I compare it to some of the Pertwee stuff where, you know, science, Miss Grant, and it's, you know, just about there, or, you know, something like Meglos, where scientists wear a different type of wig to religious people. It's just woven into the setting in a really lovely way. And all the way through, just little things like Giuliano's casually as a hobby trying to make a telescope. Just little things like that, I think, really add to the theme.
Louis Marx also wrote Planet of Giants, which I think is one of those rare stories. People forget, don't they, that it exists. How often do you ever hear people talk about Planet of Giants unless they're specifically reviewing it? Day of the Daleks, great story. Planet of Evil, and this. It was also a script editor on the Stone Tape, apparently.
Oh, okay.
So can I talk about the one big flaw that I think I found in the story?
What, the studio flaw?
No. Look, I think the one thing that detracts, and even Philip Hinchcliffe mentions this in the documentary, is the ending doesn't quite work. And I think it doesn't work for a number of reasons. One, it lacks a really big action beat that I think an ending needs. Secondly, there is a lot of baffle. And while you can sort of vaguely follow what Tom's saying about the plasma must be finite, therefore it could be split, therefore it's drained off, etc., it is sort of relying on that baffle gab. But the other thing that just confuses me is the entire lead up to the climax and the tension that's built up, and it is built up quite well, is this idea that all of these progressive scientists and progressive leaders in Renaissance Italy that are going to be part of a complete change in human outlook and culture are all going to be in this one spot, and if they're destroyed, humanity will be in a lot of trouble. Yeah. And then they destroy them all, and nobody seems to notice, because there's only about two of them survive the massacre.
And Leonardo, fortunately, doesn't turn up, does he?
No.
This is strange.
Maybe he was in on it.
I've never really understood the end. I mean, I know, essentially, he earths the helix, doesn't he, with that wire. But you know when that great scene during the dance, or the mask, I suppose, where Sarah goes up to the guy in the lion's head and thinking it's the doctor?
Yes.
And takes off the hood, and I assume we're meant to assume that's Hieronymus. And then it flicks to the temple, where the guy playing Hieronymus in the robe there is clearly the doctor. So what actually happens to Hieronymus?
Well, I think we're meant to assume that he gets earthed and drains away so the doctor can steal his cloak.
Yeah.
Possibly, yeah.
Because he's fading when we cut away from him.
Yes.
I certainly don't think the whole salami sandwich line, I know that's supposed to emphasise, oh, it was the doctor doing Hieronymus's voice. But I think it sounds very... Why is he doing it so slowly? I might even have a salami sandwich.
Well, I've always assumed that Norman Jones is just sitting behind the camera and they're literally trying to do it in sync with each other, which is why it's so forced.
But the thing is, it doesn't sound unlike Tom's voice anyway when he says that.
No.
So it's... You know, the effect is slightly lost, isn't it, as well? That's the other thing.
There's a fair bit that looks as if it's been lost in an edit. This whole idea of the old Roman temple has reappeared and then disappears again. Just seems to be sort of left.
Well, I think the problem there is that the effect of the temple being restored doesn't quite come off, because all they've done is just had the nice temple background behind some curtains and just turn the lights up so you can sort of see it through the curtains. Mm-hmm. But I think particularly on modern television and Blu-ray, it still looks like it's behind curtains. And so it doesn't quite pull off that idea of, oh my goodness, our temple has been restored. I get what they're trying for, but it doesn't quite come off.
I think that goes back to a little bit to what you were saying earlier about the special effects. For me, anyway, they very clearly don't quite convince. I can see what they're trying to do, and I think what they've done is actually pretty ingenious. But, you know, it's clearly a plug hole with stuff swirling around in it that's supposed to be the Mandragora helix. And the sparkler, although the head of the sparkler as well, that's supposed to be the helix energy, even though that's very cleverly done, and it's probably... I mean, I don't know how else they would have done it at the time anyway, especially for the amount of money and apparently the amount of skill that went involved just to make it move convincingly across the screen, which would have taken very precise skill by a cameraman to match it up with what was actually going on screen. Like Dave said there, I think the problem is when we're watching a lot of this stuff, we're watching it on, in, you know, high definition, we're watching it on Blu-rays, you know, on big screens.
Hmm.
And it's easy to forget how you know, how much more convincing things like that would have looked on the smaller old TVs that we had.
Yeah,
I think that's right. But I think that the highlighting of the camera work is important, because the location filming on this is some of the best that I think the show does. It's very clear
gorgeous,
that they've got you know, a very good director, some very good cameramen, and the use of Port Merion is exceptionally clever, because watching it back again now, having only been there a few weeks ago, you do appreciate just how carefully they filmed it so that only the Italian bits can be seen. And then, linking, you know, he walks down that road and then he's going down some stairs on the other side of the village, and all linked absolutely fantastically. Great shots of the Doctor and others on horseback. It looks just gorgeous. I don't think the filming in that sense has aged badly at all.
No, can I just say, as I'm a big fan of the Prisoner TV series, and so I'm very familiar with Port Merion from that. But at no point when I'm watching this do I actually feel like we're in the Prisoner's Village. Never once. I'm totally sold that it's the location that it's supposed to be within the story.
Yes.
I'm never taken out of it and thinking, oh, of course, this is that. Again, like Dave said, they do that so well with the positioning and the blocking off of stuff. It's brilliant work.
The only time I noticed was a couple of shots of Number Two's house are very clearly Number Two's house, and they were the only times I've gone, oh, that's Number Two's house. But otherwise, no. Even that balcony that Federico is standing on in the cliffhanger to Part One, it's filmed as though it's the frontage of a palace, and then later on you see them walking by. But that is literally just an arch with a back door that goes out into another street. It is completely two-dimensional. So it's just amazing how they've made that look like the front of a palace.
Right next to that, there's a building off of these follies, which is not Italian Renaissance at all. But what I found interesting is that the other thing, talking about getting these camera angles right, the other thing Rodney Bennett directed was Ark in Space.
Yes.
And that's very much about camera angles, isn't it? You know, you've got that just short... curve of exterior corridor they built for Ark in Space, which, as long as you get the camera angle right, makes you think that it's an entire 360-degree corridor, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then you just move the camera to the other end, and it gives you an entire... That was clever. And I wonder if that's another thing that Philip Hinchcliffe thought on that. There was a nice piece by Toby Haydock in DWM 509, after Rodney Bennett had died, where he said that they're interviewing various people about, oh, what was it like to work with Rodney Bennett? And no one has a bad word to say about him. I know, if he's died, no one's going to say, oh, yeah, he was awful. Or even if he was alive, unless, obviously, they're interviewing Christopher H. Bidmead. What did he say about Russell? Oh, he's a very good first draft for a writer. But it all sounds very genuine. And Philip Hinchcliffe's got this lovely line where he says, he was genuinely surprised, I think. This is Rodney Bennett. He was genuinely surprised, I think, by his Doctor Who fame, but in the end, quietly delighted. It's a lovely thing to say about someone, isn't it? So he sounds like one of these people like, you know, Tom and Liz are always rhapsodising how wonderful it was to work with David Maloney. There's a lot of... Of course, we've got to remember, this is penultimate story, isn't it? It's... I think once you realise that, you think... Because there's no suggestion, is there? That it's not like the Tegan thing where you're constantly thinking, right from Logopolis, Tegan is making it clear that she'd like to bugger off back to Heathrow, isn't she? But we've only got one more story with her. And there's some lovely stuff. You know her line at the end of Hand of Fear, where she says, I'm sick of being cold and wet, hypnotised left, right and centre, shot at, savaged by bug-eyed monsters. Well, if you're doing a Sarah suffering bingo game, Mask of Mandragora alone gives you a good chance of making a line of most of those, isn't it? She gets a lot of those.
Yes.
It's a bit of a trope, isn't it, for poor old Sarah to be hypnotised or have her mind taken over, be possessed or something in pretty much every other story, I think.
Yes, and Ritual Sacrifice has to be up there as well.
Yes,
yeah. Let's play a game of Sarah suffering bingo. 6 and 5, buried alive. But I think there's some gorgeous stuff here between Sarah and the Doctor. Just the friendship between the two of them. I've always love it when the Doctor says in Seeds of Doom,
have you met Miss Smith? She's my best friend.
Yeah. I always love the idea that they're best friends. One of my favourite things is... I was going to say, I've said this before on this podcast, but ironically, one of the things I'm always saying on this podcast is, I've said this before on this podcast, but one of the things I love is, particularly with actually any companion, but it works really well between the Doctor and Sarah, is when they have totally inconsequential exchanges, which have nothing to do with the plot, but which actually you imagine, well, when they're going around the universe together and they're not actually dodging monsters and trying to save the world and everything, they must have just normal conversations with each other about life. Like, for instance, in Planet of Evil, where the Doctor's quoted Shakespeare, and then they just wander off into the jungle.
That was lucky.
Fortunately, time is on our side.
Time?
Yes. Night's candles are burned out. Okay. And Jock and Day stands tiptoe on the misty mountaintop. Or something like that.
Oh, you mean it's getting light?
That's what Shakespeare meant. I met him once, you know.
Who?
Shakespeare. Charming fellow. Dreadful actor.
Perhaps that's why he took up writing.
Perhaps it was.
Just things like that, it makes you convinces you they are best friends. I mean, I love the bit where they're in Hieronymus's room and the Doctor's doing his sums on a piece of paper and Sarah's just wandering up and down behind him with her arms folded and he's muttering, you know, square root of... blah, 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 blah. 17 from 60 is... And she just looks over his shoulder and says, 43, thanks.
Yes.
Delicious. There's some gorgeous stuff. When Giuliano said, should I cancel the dance? And the Doctor says,
you're going to hold a dance?
Well, only if you don't think it's too dangerous.
Dangerous? My dear Duke, you've got lots of guests to entertain. Of course you must hold a hop. Sarah will love it. Ask her.
Oh, yes, just my scene.
And Giuliano, save me a costume. I love a knees up.
And then one of the nicest scenes, I think, of all of it is where, you know, the Doctor puts on the lion's head and he plays at being silly, roaring, and he says, remember the French at Agincourt?
Remember the French at Agincourt?
But they lost. You know, the worse the situation, the worse your jokes get.
And then the Doctor takes off the mask and sort of calms down and Sarah says,
I think I'll settle for the lion.
Things are bad, aren't they?
Yes.
Very bad.
Desperately bad, but we can only do our best and help. Are you coming?
Now, I think that is so... Oh, that's... I love that. I mean, Sarah's response on this clip is probably not audible, but what she does is she just nods and quietly says, yep, because it's so much better than, you remember, I don't want to sort of, I'm dissing David, but you know in the beginning of The Impossible Planet where the TARDIS lands on the base and Rose says, oh, if
you think there's going to be trouble, we could always get back inside and go somewhere else.
They collapse in hysterical laughter at the very thought that people as brave and as venturous as them would ever run away from danger. And yet, that's entirely expressed by the Doctor just saying to Sarah, you coming? Yeah. And wander off together. You know the way they completely underplay her departure at the end of Hand of Fear?
Yes.
Sarah's not bursting into tears. The Doctor's not, so I don't want her to go or anything. I think, oh, I adore that. There's a great moment which is almost worth getting the DVD out again just to rewatch this. But when part one, where they land in the Mandragora Helix and they're in that black studio floor and the fizzing energy comes towards them and they run to hide behind the TARDIS, Tom gets there first to the far corner of the TARDIS. And as Liz runs round it, he picks her up under the arms and swings her around the rest of the corner. And her feet are almost come off the floor at waist height. It's a really great moment. I don't know if they planned it or if it was just, but it's clearly one of the sort of things where you can't for once imagine. Liz's quote was quite petite, wasn't she? You can't imagine him doing that to Louise or to Lala. Or to Mary at all.
Or to Matthew.
I'll put the clip on our Tumblr page, links to which can be found in our show notes, as ever, at www.diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. I think you can perfectly see that when Tom's saying, oh, I was devastated when Liz left, it's not just he actually means it. And I'm sure the fact that both of them are Scousers has something to do with it.
And also the fact that they were both there at the start. I mean, Tom, we all know the story about Tom. He came off, you know, working as a prickie to suddenly star in the show and took it to new heights, and she was there with him. I think that sense of they were all there together building this thing up must be an important part of it. But you're right, they get some amazing dialogue. And there's also a really good Fourth Doctor scene in there. I think it's in part one or part two where he first confronts Frederico and Hieronymus. Again, you watch that great ability of Tom Baker to lurch between the ridiculous and the sincere. Because one moment he's just puncturing Hieronymus and doing the whole, well, it depends on if the cock laid addled eggs, and being very sort of flippant and puncturing the self-importance. But then he brings it down because there's that wonderful exchange where Frederico says, can you tell the future? No, because you haven't got one. That, you know, that's a really good line. And because, as I'm sure you guys have spoken about a number of times with Tom's performance, because he's changed the level, it has so much more impact.
Yeah, there's a bit like that as well when they've kidnapped Sarah, haven't they? And they're making off with her, and Tom's just suddenly, stop.
Yes.
And again, it's underplayed, isn't it?
Stop.
Now put the girl down. Gently.
And the other thing he does with that at that point with the Hieronymus is he says he's joking around and he suddenly does that thing where he completely changes the tone and says that line about all it takes is a glib tongue.
Do you tell the future?
Sometimes.
Can you tell mine?
No.
Why not?
Because you don't have a future unless you listen to me.
Answer me this. What does it signify when Venus is in opposition to Saturn and a great shadow passes over the moon?
This is all a great waste of time.
Answer him.
Well, it depends, doesn't it?
On what?
On whether the moon is made of cheese, on whether the cock crows three times before dawn and 12 hens lay addled eggs.
What school of philosophy is that?
I can easily teach him. All it requires is a colourful imagination and a glib tongue.
Oh, lovely. Lovely, that sort of thing. 4 and 2 locked in the loo. 9 and 7, sent to Devon.
2 and 9, possessed her mind.
5 and 4, chased by a dinosaur.
35, hypnotised. Not quite.
1 and 5, Eldred must live. Sorry, Dave.
No, that's okay. You had to get that out of your system.
17, is that the Spider Queen on your back?
Before you can do any more.
I promise to shut up now.
What did you two make of the relationship between Giuliano and Marco?
I'm not sure. Computer, what did you make of the relationship between Giuliano and Marco?
Once I had a secret love.
Yes, thank you, computer. Relationship between Giuliano and Marco. You'll have to elaborate, Dave. Well, it's very... I couldn't... So when you know when they're all chained up in the dungeons, I couldn't help think of... maybe this story could have been called... When they were thinking of all their various titles for the story, they could have called it Dungeons on Pharos. Because it's very... it's very Jason Connery, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so those burn marks on Marco on his chest are really nasty.
Yes! They had people writing in complaining about the horrific torture scenes, didn't they? They pointed out, we never actually show any torture scenes.
No. It reminds me of that bit in Elizabeth R where Thomas Parry has confessed that, you know, he's been up to these nefarious things, and Cat actually says, how could you do that? And he says, but they showed me the instruments.
Yeah, the relationship between Giuliano and Marco. So it's I've been watching quite a lot of Hitchcock lately, quite often in tandem with my eldest daughter, who's watching it in Cardiff. And there's a couple of films particularly where she started talking about gay coding. I do wonder, is it wrong to see gay coding in their relationship? Or is that just purely a result of that being like a, you know, two Shakespearean characters, then that's just the way they are.
Yeah, it's interesting. Hitchcock is certainly a really nice reference, because there's at least one Hitchcock film where it wasn't coding. The deliberate intent of the director was that this was a gay couple, so Hitchcock was absolutely doing that.
Was that Rope?
Is that where they murder someone and then have a
party? Rope.
Who was that? James Mason and
No. It's James Stewart.
James Stewart and John Dahl. I think that's a really good point you raised there, Mark. And look, it's a good to reference Hitchcock, because if you look at some of Hitchcock's movies, particularly something like Rope, it wasn't just a sort of a subtext or a coding. Like, the intent of that movie was that they absolutely were a gay couple. So I think that's a really, really good reference.
Yes.
I don't think it's much of a giveaway to say that they murder someone, seeing as that's literally the first scene.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
That's true.
So I think that's a really good antecedent or comparison to bring up. I think you can read it both ways. You could read it as of that very sort of Shakespearean close friends. But there are moments, for example, Giuliano does refer to him as my dear Marco. The scene where Giuliano walks into the cell and he goes to the doctor and the doctor says, go to Marco, is again, could be read that way. But when they're in the throne room in part 4, Marco does take his place in the consort's throne, so I don't know if there was something there or not.
Yes, I noticed that.
And my secret love's no secret anymore.
Yes, thank you, computer. I mean, I do wonder how much would this even occur to us if they weren't wearing tights and codpieces. They were just in jeans and T-shirts. Would we even suspect there was anything going on?
Yes. Although there is that scene right at the end, isn't there, where Giuliano is saying goodbye to Sarah Jane, and Sarah Jane comments and says, oh, he's ever so wistful, isn't he?
The thing is, if you'd already seen Leela going off with Andred, with absolutely no preparation of the plot for it at the end of Invasion of Time, you might be thinking here, oh my God, Sarah's about to say to the Doctor, no, I'm staying to become the Duchess of San Martino.
Well, that probably would have been a more fitting end for her than the Hand of Fear.
Talking of Giuliano, someone mentioned, I read, we noticed how Giuliano cuts his hair like Dave Hill from Slade.
Yes. While we're on the subject of some of the characters as well, I'd just like to do a shout out to Count Federico. Is he? He's a count, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
A right count.
So I'd just like to do a shout out to Count Federico, actually. I really do enjoy his character because he's basically just a vain, vicious thug, isn't he? And what I love about his character is that you've got Hieronymus and the Mandragora Helix who are looking to take over the entirety of the planet of Earth. And he's there scheming away going, one day I'll be Duke. So, it seems so petty. And I really like that.
It does. And the dynamic between Federico and Hieronymus is also really, really good, is that you can just quietly sense the power shift in that relationship. And at first, Federico pushes back, you know, who do you think you are? But as Hieronymus gets more confident, you can start to see Federico sort of go, hang on, something's happening here and I'm not quite comfortable. It's really well played.
Yeah.
A bit where Hieronymus refuses to stand up.
Yes.
And then he remembers that he's still mortal, so he's like, oh, bugger.
I mean, if you're an actor, I think, in this, you'd always want to... Tim Pigott Smith and Gareth Armstrong are far too young to play it. But if you're an actor, you'd want to get the role of Count Federico, wouldn't you? Because they've got all the best lines. It's like, I suppose Marco and Giuliano, it's like being cast as a tenor in an opera, isn't it? They're the nice guys who go around and say, oh, let's don't be mean to people. Whereas you really want, if you're an actor, to get your teeth into lines like when he calls the Doge that fox-faced old blowhard.
Any part where you can use the word oaf a couple of times is a good part.
Yeah. I do think the sets are wonderful in this, and I do think that the outside-to-inside stuff is, if you're really engaged in the plot, which I must have been, because I wasn't noticing it, I didn't notice the switches from outside to inside. Certainly I didn't notice any switches from film to video.
No, that's true, actually. It was very well done.
I think that a lot of that's to do with the lighting. I think it's, the interiors aren't flatly lit like a lot of Doctor Who can be. It's, you know, where it's just like studio lights are either on or off. And, you know, you actually get shadows and bright points of focus and stuff. And it's atmospheric. And I think that really helps with the indoor shooting. So you don't have that jarring transition from going from film to videotape.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, apparently, who did the design on this?
Was this Barry Newbury one?
Yes.
Yes, Barry Newbury was wandering around, as it must happen so many times, as it was wandering around Television Centre, just, to see what people were doing. And it was it Stephanie Grappelli or was it Yehudi Menuhin? The BBC were doing a big celebration. And for God knows why, they built that set of the Count's bedroom, you know, where he's sitting on his sort of big chair, telling his servant to stop fussing and stuff like that and playing chess. They built that as the set for this Yehudi Menuhin thing. And he just said to them, had a quiet word with the props guys and said, when you finish this, don't chuck this set out. Keep it somewhere safe for me, will you, please? I do find all the praise be to Demnos stuff at the altar terribly boring. It just goes on and on and on, bloody hell. What I found really interesting in reading up on this is that Philip Hinchcliffe says he had watched The Mask of the Red Death, the one with Vincent Price.
Yes.
And apparently Machiavelli, he wrote this work in the early 1500s called The Mandrake or The Mandragola. He'd been... frozen out of the sort of court life at Florence, and he was really annoyed at it. And Mandragora, that's got to be some kind of inspiration for this, especially given how much Louis Marx would have known about the era.
Yeah.
I read on this, he says, some scholars read this play as an overt critique of the House of the Medici on Machiavelli's part. So I thought... In other words, this is Machiavelli's version of the comeuppance of Captain Cat. Peter Grimway, he just on that a day Machiavelli. I don't, I'm not really sure it's... Is this Tom's only historical? Apart from Pyramids?
Well, I mean, Talons.
Well done. Something I thought was interesting when I just happened upon a scan of the Radio Times page and I was looking at this, and it's the BBC scheduling lineup for Saturday nights, which always seems from my can't have been on for more than a few years. It always seems from my childhood to have been the sort of time when I was when and if you used to do this, you're sitting cross-legged on the floor right in front of the TV, and the rest of the family's sitting behind on the three-piece suite. It was the days when we didn't have remote controls, and so not only did you have to get up and press a button on the TV to change channels, but you had to get up, put your hand on top of the TV, and really force in the channel change button, and make sure that holding the TV so it didn't knock the vase of flowers off the top of it. And so people really did sit down, start with one channel at the beginning of the night and just keep watching.
Absolutely.
Because this had, at the time when this was broadcast, Mandragora, it went from, they started with Grandstand, all the sports on a Saturday afternoon, and you went to Doctor Who, The Generation Game, The Duchess of Duke Street, The Two Ronnies, Starsky and Hutch, Match of the Day, and Parkinson.
Have you missed out Basil Brush?
Oh, yes, it would probably have come between
Grandstand and...
But Grandstand and Doctor Who, wouldn't it? And that's, I mean, that's a glorious. I know you look back now and it seems so tacky, but I used to adore The Generation Game. So Brucey was at his height. It's not like towards the end of his time when they used to open Strictly with him. Don't really watch Strictly, but occasionally when I'm in the family home, I had to watch it. And Brucey originally started tap dancing down that long flight of stairs at the opening, didn't he? And then a few years on, it's very noticeable that it would open with him already halfway down the stairs, so that he only had to tap dance down a few stairs. But he was great. And this, the whole thing about, a Generation Game, which is very Brucey, isn't it? I mean, he used to carry it into things like Play Your Cards Right and Price is Right, where he's doing this thing of the whole thing is a complete chaos and he's only just managing to hold it together.
All right, wear your glasses, dear.
Sorry.
No, well,
I can't see anything if I put them on now.
Oh, I see. You've got a... have we really got research people on this show? French maid who's called Daphne and blind as a bat. Anyway.
Yeah, sadly, none of this will mean anything to Dave.
No, you poor thing.
I only know The Generation Game because of the Goodies parody.
Ah, yes, of course.
Duchess of Duke Street, something I intend to introduce Mark to. It's one of those 1970s hugely long BBC drama series, which is just absolutely fabulous. Lalo Ward's debut. Two Ronnies, always funny. But first, a few items of late news.
First, the news. Britain's gravediggers came out on strike this morning, and this afternoon the undertakers came out in deepest sympathy.
Music. And a team of researchers in Salzburg have uncovered an early Mozart score. She was only 16 and lived over the bakery opposite.
Right. I've pretty much exhausted everything I've got to say.
As have I.
I've one person who I'd like to mention whose name I don't think we've brought up yet, which is James Acheson, who did the costuming and the masks on this. He's absolutely brilliant. No one makes a mask for Doctor Who quite like him, do they? He's responsible for the Robots of Death as well, isn't he? Yeah, the costume design on this, and as Dave alluded to earlier, like the size of the cast that he would have been having to dress as well. And the number of masks, because, you know, for a Doctor Who production, for a BBC drama production, there's a surprisingly large number of people at the dance, isn't there?
Yeah. You know?
And he's got to provide masks for them all. He's got to provide masks for all the cultists as well. So, yeah, incredible work. And some of those masks are absolutely gorgeous. You know, I love Tom. Again, it's one of those things that It kind of doesn't look quite so good close up, but his lion mask that he wears when he's doing his little posing. Sorry, you can't see me, but I'm doing the hands in the air sort of thing. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, just great work from James Acheson.
Dudley Simpson as well does some really good work here. And again, you get that sense that they've all had a bit of a break from the end of the season and just come back a little bit fresher and just performing a little bit better than maybe they do sometimes.
Yeah. Also, now you mentioned Dudley Simpson as well. When I was listening to this, this has some great Dudley Simpson work, and it really takes me back. I get that kind of Pavlovian response to it. That I'm suddenly like, I can almost see the living room that I sat in when I was a child watching it, just from his music cues.
Yeah.
And as Doc said then, like your family sat on the three-piece suite behind you while you're sat on the floor in front of the telly. I can even remember the tea, you know. It's like a hard-boiled egg with salad and salad cream and something called salad seasoning, which you can't get anymore, which is a variety of spices and stuff that you sprinkle over it.
Was that yellow?
It was orangey. It had sesame seeds in it and stuff. And I used to hate salad, so I used to absolutely drench my tea in salad cream and salad seasoning. Like I say, Pavlovian response from the...
That wasn't called Aromat, was it?
No. It's literally called... It was Schwartz.
Okay.
Literally, like I say, those cues just take me right back there. It's amazing, really.
I don't want to say, Mark, when we go to all the trouble to build up this this picture, and we have the listeners imagining us sitting in and chatting in this enormous, elaborately decorated atrium hung with tapestries and... mosaics of Gary Downie on the floor. When you drop in lines like, of course you can't see me doing this, it rather destroys the illusion.
I'm over here, hidden behind the sofa.
Mark, will you come out from behind that tapestry, please? Right then. Shall we do it to marks out of 10?
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I come back to what I said at the very start. There's a lot to recommend this story, but it is near great rather than great, and I'm giving it an 8.5.
Oh.
Mark? Oh, sorry, Marco.
Thank you. Well, when I was watching it, there were times during it where I was finding it a bit of a, you know, like you say, the crypt scenes and stuff. And yeah. I was thinking, I don't know, maybe in the scheme of things, this is a 6 for Tom. But as we've been talking about it, actually, I've suddenly found myself rolling it around in my mind and sort of chewing over it again. And I think I will give it a 7. And it's an enjoyable 7 because Tom's great in it. Liz is great in it.
Yeah.
In a way, a bit like my Planet of Fire review, which I apologise to Dave for that because I know Dave's a big fan of Planet of Fire.
It's my favourite Davo story.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. But I think there's lots that's really good in it. It's a very competently produced story and the cast are great, but I just don't quite get the level of enjoyment out of it that maybe I would do. And no. I think Dave's right as well in that its problem probably is that it's surrounded by these fantastic stories like Seeds of Doom.
Yes, exactly.
Robots of Death, etc., etc., Brain of Morbius.
And I believe I would give it a 7.5. When it's good, it's very, very good. But when it's all praising to Demnos, it can be decidedly, you know, checking and watching. God, get on with it.
Oh, can I just apologise if there's been any extraneous sounds coming over the microphone that you'll have to edit out because I've had a stomach problem because my astro sextant rectifier has gone out of phase.
I'm not sure I get that, but...
It's a line that the doctor delivers in this story early on.
I got it.
But I've been waiting for a moment to crowbar it in, and I've had no choice. I do like a bit of techno babble.
Right. So we should say thanks for your company, Dave, to review Mask of Mandragora. I think if anyone's going to be reviewing iTunes, they might be seeing this new half-Welsh, half-Australian podcast that I've been listening to the last few episodes. Just seem a little niche to me. So, oh, look who's coming down the corridor to say goodbye. It's the Sons of Scarab. It's far more complicated, editorially, to put in this farewell. If we had someone who could do an Uncle Terence impersonation. Oh.
Well, I mean, I can do other voices.
I'm not having you doing...
Bernard Mandrell.
Doing Bernard Mandrell.
Oh.
No, because Bernard Mandrell is Dave.
Well, no, he's not. See, I've retired it. Because although it was only something I threw in at the last minute when you asked me to read something out, and I was like, oh, shall I put a voice on? And he said, okay. And I just picked a random... I only have a limited number of voices, I'm afraid, Dave. So, and because it's so unlike your actual voice, it amused me greatly to read it out like this. Absolutely nothing personal in it at all, just purely. So I hope no offence was caused.
Look who's coming to say goodbye to us. It's Bernard Mandrell.
Oh, I'm Bernard Mandrell. Not Dave Kitchen.
Uncle Bernard. Hang on. Uncle Bernard, what's the state of the canals near your club up in Manchester?
Well, I've got one thing to say about that. Don't dump bodies into the canal.
Uncle Bernard, we have woke comedy reviewers in Sector 47.
It's a trap!
Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Set course for Titan 3.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook, and Mastodon at Diddly Dumb, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dumb, the empty space that circles time, I mean, time, Chesterton.